Hello, this is Johnny Moore in London.
And this is Viv McWaters in Australia.
And this is David Robinson in Seattle, United States.
Thanks for joining this podcast on the subject of the tyranny of excellence. And David, I know that you talk a lot about the peril of going for excellence and how it often stops creativity from happening.
Yeah, there's actually a tenet that comes from improvisational theater that deals with the idea that in order to access your greatest creativity, you need to put down the idea of perfection. And that, and the way that it's said in the world of improvisational theater is to put down your clever and pick up your ordinary. And the idea is that the things that every person judges as their most ordinary, the thing, in fact, that they try to hide or diminish is usually their greatest gift, the thing that makes them the most potent and the most powerful. And so that to access it, it's required that you put down your need to be right or your need to be clever or your need to be smart and just be present with what you are and who you are, which allows for all kinds of messiness and spontaneity.
So, David, you were talking a while back about this notion of putting down your clever and picking up your ordinary and relating it back to the hero and the anti-hero. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is actually, you know, this idea. I have a coaching practice and also teach. And there was one of the students or one of the coaches, he's quite a brilliant man, was in the class, and he actually introduced this idea to us. And the way that he brought it forward was he was having this revelation as he was speaking it. And he said, you know, my whole life I've been trying to get rid of the anti-hero or the big dog barking in my head telling me I'm wrong or I'm not good enough. And his word for that was anti-hero. And he said, for years and years and years, he's tried all kinds of things, you know, to rid himself of this anti-hero. And then one day, through this class, he had this revelation that there's a balance point, and the balance point is the hero. And that the reason he has such a great, big anti-hero is that he's all the time trying to be perfect. He's trying to be the hero. And the route to getting rid of the anti-hero is to release the idea of perfection, is to release the hero and really allow himself to walk in that middle way. And that was a great revelation for me when he said that, that you know, the pursuit of the hero is what creates the anti-hero. The pursuit of the kind of rigid perfectionism or trying to be excellent all the time, whatever that means, creates this enormous monster in our inner dialogue that yaps at us all the time. And you can't resist that. You can't push against it. But the way to really eliminate it is to let go of the perfection, let go of the hero.
I think one of the things that happens when we allow ourselves to be ordinary is I think we make it easier for other people to have a relationship with us.
Yes.
And I think, you know, in facilitation, that's always worth bearing in mind. You know, when you're facilitating, the pressure is sometimes on. You feel like, oh, well, you've got to have a dramatic impact in order to justify your existence. But I think that striving often just cuts us off from people and cuts us off from relating. And I also think that the urge to be individually marvelous is, again, denying other people the opportunity to sort of finish off our thoughts, to add to what we're saying, to improve on what we're doing. Now, if we're attached to being the perfect one, we're closing the option for them to do that. And if they try to do it, we're likely to resent it. So I think there's something about allowing ourselves to do average or ordinary, which does leave the rest of the world a chance to look in and a chance to relate to us.
And I would even, you know, I would add something to that, that there's a Parker Palmer, and he's written a terrific book called The Courage to Teach. And in it, he draws these two models, which are really two ways of working. And one is being the expert, and the other is having a subject-focused engagement. And I think part of what you just said, Johnny, that come forward for me is that it's in fact, it locks people out when we try to be the expert of anything. To go into a group with the idea that we know shuts off relationship. And so that the word that I always offer as a way of how do you get better and better and better within this subject-focused ongoing conversation that I think is what good learning is. I think it's what good facilitation is. I think it's what good art is the word mastery. And by that I mean that you do the thing that you do to get better and better and better at doing it. It's not about knowing everything. It's about it's like being a good woodworker. How do I work in such a way that I become more efficient, more available, that relationship that you talk about with others also extends within yourself, so that I'm having this relationship with myself. It's about being more present with what's right in front of me, as opposed to what I want to or what I think should be in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
So I take myself out of the expert role. And what that does is it opens up this kind of relationship that you're talking about.
Yep.
So that this ordinary place is not a diminishment at all. It's a place of presence. And because you're present with what's there, it becomes very powerful. Mm. You're not filling in or providing answers. You're helping yourself and others lean into better questions and better relationships.
It also reminds me a bit of the distinction that some people draw between advocacy and inquiry. Because I think what goes with being excellent and being expert is people who are doing that are busy advocating. And I think we live in a world where there's a lot of selling, a lot of advocating going on.
Yeah.
At some level, I suspect most of us get very tired of that, tired of being sold to in that way. And when we talk about living more with a question, I think again, that's the way of allowing for some relationship to happen. And I think it's interesting that, you know, that book that all my contemporaries were reading when we left university, and they all rushed off to become management consultants based on that book, In Search of Excellence. And, you know, and we all know what happened to those companies. You know, virtually all of them turned out not to be excellent after all.
Right. Right.
And, you know, and the research shows it's almost impossible for any company to be sustainably excellent over a long period of time. It's kind of unnatural.
Mm.
So to release ourselves from that, I think, brings us into, you know, not perhaps so, I was going to say a different kind of world. And I think the difference is, you might at first think, well, if we abandon excellence, we're letting go of excitement. But actually, I think when we really get present to what's going on in the world, when we actually notice more of what's going on, there are more surprises just in noticing than there are in trying to be remarkable. You know, it's like that activity where you're invited to look around the room that you're in. I'm looking around the room I'm in now, which I've lived in. It's my bedroom. I've lived in this flat for 15 years. It's still perfectly easy for me to look at any part of this room, and if I choose to pay attention, to find something about it that I've not noticed before the whole time I've been here. And whenever I do an exercise like that, I am struck by there is so much here in the ordinary and the present in just what is that is interesting if we open ourselves to it, rather than striving to create magnificence the whole time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's this has been coming up for me over and over and over, and it just soared into my brain with what you just said, Johnny. I'm convinced that we are really in a time where old patterns and new demands are colliding. And this cult of excellence, it comes from an industrial age thinking. You know, the idea that time is money, that everything is kind of a factory model, that people are widgets and interchangeable, that in terms of our language use and the way that we use advocacy, you know, or being sold to, or what is a training, right? People enter into trainings with what they will, what can I get from it as opposed to what do I bring to it? What do I get is kind of an old world pattern, I believe.
Yeah.
And what's really being called for us to do is to show up with what do we bring, because the world is so fluid. This working world that we're in is so different than the time equals money paradigm. When Patty and I do a lot of work with groups, and you can do it in 2 minutes to show them that relationship is the thing that equals money. Relationship's the thing that makes us efficient and dynamic and capable of really fulfilling our potentials. And that's ongoing. This word excellence to me is an arrival word. You know, there's a train station and you arrive at it and it's called excellence. Mm. That's why the word mastery is much more applicable to me, because it's a process word. You never get there. You don't arrive. You continually
work on the relationships or on the, you know, if it's about being a better and better facilitator or a better and better craftsperson, a better and better artist, whatever, better leader, you don't get there.
Yeah.
That in order to become masterful at something, you have to make mistakes. And you don't see them as mistakes. You see them as learnings. You know, I learn what tool can do what. And if I go against the grain, it's going to be different than if I go with the grain. And this, I think this place of putting down your clever and picking up your ordinary is the route to that. You don't become masterful if you're trying to be clever.
Yeah, that's really interesting, David, because I come up against this, you know, in myself and in others all the time that, you know, I don't want to put anything out there in the world unless it's perfect. So there seems to be this correlation between, you know, excellence and perfect, and it just sets the bar so high that it means people are actually stuck. They don't do anything rather than be seen as making a mistake. And I was reading, I think it was Seth Godin said something about if you're not making lots of mistakes, you're not being creative. So I wonder if there's something around the need to encourage ourselves and each other just to try things and see what happens. And I've described it in the past as, you know, making mud pies, and you make a mud pie and if it works, you make more of the same. And if it doesn't, you stop making that one. People react very strongly to this notion of just trying things and making mistakes. What do you think's behind that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things behind it. And one is that I've done a lot of work in education in my life. And the way that we have set up our systems of education reinforce the idea that there is an answer and it is outside of me somewhere, and that I need to look for that answer. That's a teacher has it, and if I can just get teacher to tell me what the answer is, then I can pass the test and get my A. You know, that there's a lot of, we have a lot of energy behind that. So for instance, I was just doing a lot of work with some trainers. We were doing a train the trainer thing, and we talked about how so often we go into a situation and, you know, you're scored at the end of the day. And your job is to get a perfect five, or, you know, you walk into the group and you want them to score you well, which means that, some of the trainers that I walk in sometimes and say to the group, what do I need to do to get a five? Because the only way I'm going to be invited back is to get a five. And that ultimately negates the potency of the work that you can do, because to really serve people, you often have to take them to places of discomfort. And you also often have to go to places of discomfort for yourself. So this idea of an answer that is outside of me somewhere, I think puts a lot of emphasis on the idea that you need to be clever. You can't say, I don't know.
It's a bit scary, isn't it? Because the same sort of thing is happening in education here in Australia, and I'm sure there's a similar thing happening in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this whole notion of testing and measuring, and at a certain age a child should be able to do a certain thing, and we should be able to test that, and we can relate that directly back to the teacher and the education system. And it just seems so mechanistic. And
yeah.
You know, 19th century compared with the world we're actually living in. And it seems that the, you know, the policymakers and others are just not seeing, they're not present to what's actually happening around them. So, you know, I think it's an indicator, if I want to use an indicator, of this cult of excellence, or this tyranny of excellence, that unless we strive for that, unless we get that, we're failing, and they see anything else as a failure. So I was struck by a workshop that I did recently, which by all accounts was a failure, because the client wasn't happy, you know, all sorts of reasons. And I've pondered what happened as a result of that. for myself as a facilitator. And there's such a expectation that a facilitator or a teacher or somebody like that, the person up the front of the room, has the answers and will be liked.
Right.
And it's such a, and to put yourself into that situation where, yes, I know what this group of people need to do to move forward, plus they're going to like me during the process, is such a huge ask that I think it's nearly impossible.
Yeah.
So I started looking at the role of facilitator as disruptor or a circuit breaker, coming in and asking the questions that others are not prepared to ask, or pointing out the inconsistencies or the ridiculousness of some situation that everybody knows but no one's prepared to say. And when you actually say that, it doesn't mean that people are necessarily happy to hear that. So there's always a reaction of some sort.
I think it goes with the notion that somehow in organizations, an organization is succeeding if, and everyone is getting along, if everybody's doing more or less the same thing. I've been writing recently about what Richard Farson has to say about training, and he says the trouble with training is it seems to be about getting everybody to be the same, which is kind of in denial of the fact that people are different, and that the organizations that we work in are actually complex, and they actually succeed because people aren't doing the same thing, because there is actually diversity. And so any group that's functioning terribly well should actually have some dissent, some discomfort, and some disagreement. It shouldn't all be neatly aligned. There's got to be some difference and some friction. And I recognize in what you're saying, Viv, that often when I'm briefed on a coaching or a facilitation job, or even at the beginning of it, I'm sitting there wishing that I had some magic answer and realizing I don't. I don't know. I'm not sure how this is going to work. There isn't a standard answer to this, because we're dealing with human beings. We're not robots. We're not cogs. The friction and the confusion and the dissent is natural. And if you fill in happy sheets at the end of a workshop, and let's say 20 people come, if 20 people all say it was great, well, there's something wrong somewhere. It's not natural for them to agree to that degree. And if they, you know, maybe there are occasionally fantastic group experience, but mostly you should expect some dissent, and that would be healthy.
You know, when Patty and I now start working with clients, we, before we ever get to the day in the very early work when they're looking to hire us, we have a conversation with them now that's largely about this very thing. You know, so that we're setting up from the very beginning that our role is to come in and to stir their pot. And that if we're effective, it's going to be uncomfortable for them, or potentially, you know, very uncomfortable, that we're not there to create agreement. Or, I, you know, Johnny, as you're saying, this kind of homogenous, no conflict world, because, you know, I come from a background in the art and have learned that I have radically different definitions for things like collaboration. It's never been in my tradition that collaboration meant everybody has equal voice and everybody's in agreement. Mm-hmm. You know, that collaboration is that we all have radically different points of view, and we are in service to a vision that, you know, in this case, the director holds. And that director, at the end of the day, is going to say, right, this is where we're going. It's not equal voice. You're expected to bring in different points of view, because that's what creates something that's bigger than any one of us.
That's interesting, David, because so often people ask us to get agreement or consensus, or, you know, everybody lined up with the same view, and it's so contrary to the expectation that people will bring different points of view and people will disagree, and in the end, heaven forbid, someone's got to make a decision.
Right.
You know, it's about putting off decision making as well.
There's this concept, you know, that we talked about this in the class, but it comes up for me. It's a story concept that I think is in metaphor what we're talking about, and that is, you know, this thing with you know, in Little Red Riding Hood, what is the one character you need to propel the story forward?
Mm.
And it's the wolf. You need the obstacle. You need the wolf to make your story move forward. And the same is true in organizations. It's true in our individual lives. The obstacles are the things that we see as obstacles, or oppositions, are the things that propel us forward. And yet we spend a lot of time trying to remove those things. I said this to the group the other day. If you had absolutely no obstacles in your life, what would happen? And they all laughed and said we'd be bored and we would go out and create them. And that's right. That's exactly what you would do. I think hobbies are all about creating obstacles. You take on things that you don't know how to do so that you can get better at doing them. And you enjoy that. Nobody does a puzzle that they know how to do because then there's no engagement. The obstacle that creates the engagement. And in all of these stories, things are not easy. They're not meant to be easy. You all often think you're on the wrong path. You get lost. You drop things. You're the ring bearer and you get everybody in a world of trouble. But ultimately, it's exactly what was supposed to happen because we all learn from it and we all come back different.
Well, I think marks out a satisfying group from an unsatisfying one. Let's set that up. I tend to set that up as the bar rather than having some abstract measure of achievement. Is a group that probably has uncovered some differences, hasn't necessarily resolved everything, but perhaps has agreed, not always explicitly, but has agreed to go on together and to keep going. Yeah. I mean, and you talk about those, if you want the Lord of the Rings story analogy, it's not that there isn't difficulty or difference. It's that you are willing to keep going on, keep on exploring. Rather than aiming for some neat set of pseudo agreements and commitments, which, you know, I call them commitment ceremonies, which is what often we're expected to end a 1 or 2 day workshop with, is a list of things that we've all agreed. Now, you know, there may be some things that we've agreed, but that forced sort of, oh, we've been successful because we've agreed a number of things, I think is quite unsatisfying. And some of the best things I've been to, you know, particularly with open space, the best open spaces I've been to end where people aren't really that clear what's been achieved, but they do get that something useful has happened. They just haven't quite worked out what it is yet. And it's perhaps only over time that they get to see what things have been started and what's been actioned as a result of that. And there isn't that, we seem to be able in those circumstances to suspend this requirement for a neat and tidy conclusion that shows we've made linear progress in favor of, I think, a more felt sense of having got somewhere, even though we can't say exactly what it is. And then I think that willingness to settle for ambivalence or ambiguity and carry on is perhaps, in a lot of situations, a more sane response than the striving for proving that you've achieved things and been really excellent.
Yeah, and I would say it's a more honest response. I think what you said is articulated so beautifully. I think in a way it puts down the lie that we do come to these clean 100%, we're all on board agreements. And I think, you know, another thing, Johnny, that popped up for me in what you were saying is that in open space, you're not nobody's negating anybody. That the way that we are together is a yes and, not a yes but way. That we're working where open space kind of affords that capacity to engage in processes that aren't about being right or closing the other person off or determining the path. But we're really going to engage around a subject and let it be as messy and as big. And we move forward, but we can't quite say how.
So what it comes back to for me is all about relationships. So what you were saying, Johnny, about open space, is about giving people time to have conversations and be in relationship. And David, you're talking about, you know, the relationship that we have with ourselves and giving ourselves some slack and actually recognizing and acknowledging and valuing relationships that we have with other people instead of trying to be someone that we're not. So for me, it just comes back to that whole thing about relationships and that common human element that we bring to any situation.
So I guess if in our collective beef against the tyranny of excellence, if we're against excellence, what we're for is relationship with connectedness and being able to move on together.
I would say that. Yes.
But that's a dangerously tidy thing for us to agree on at the end of a podcast.
I think we
need some dissent or we're going to be in a terrible philosophical jam here, aren't we?
I know. Somebody's going to call our bluff or something.
I'll tell you what. We'll let the listeners add the dissent to it.
There we go. That's it. What a terrific conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Viv. Let's do it again soon.
Yes.
Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, David.
Take care.